The matter of Stephen Resnick, may we please have appearances?
Good afternoon, Timothy McNamara, Assistant Ethics Counsel for the Office of Attorney Ethics.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Mark Gross. I'm here on behalf of the respondent, Mr. Resnick, who is seated behind me. Just one point of information. Mr. Resnick is hearing impaired. I'll speak up. Mr. Resnick is hearing impaired, and he adjusts his assisted devices with his iPhone. So it's not that he's emailing or texting during this proceeding. He just may need to hear a little bit
better. No problem. Thank you. Thank you for the explanation. Mr. McNamara.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Rabner and Justices of the Court. The Disciplinary Review Board found that respondent committed 14 violations of the rules of professional conduct. 14. Five members of the Disciplinary Review Board voted to censure respondent, and three members of the board voted for a 3-month suspension. Respondent concludes his brief to this court by arguing that to the extent any discipline is warranted, that the discipline should be limited to an admonition recommended by the special master. The Disciplinary Review Board's view, meanwhile, is that the special master overlooked significant portions of this record and failed to appreciate the gravity of respondent's pattern of misconduct in two separate client matters. The board determined that respondent's serious misconduct establishes that an admonition falls well short of the mark. Respondent spends a significant portion of his brief to this court emphasizing the passage of time. And the Office of Attorney Ethics acknowledges that the passage of time is a mitigating factor to consider when imposing discipline. Judges Farber and Weissenbeck referred the matters to the Office of Attorney Ethics in October of 2013, and Judge Kirsch referred the matter to the Office of Attorney Ethics in March of 2014. In this case, the matters were placed on untriable status for nearly 2 years following respondents' counsel's prior counsel reporting to the Office of Attorney Ethics that the Siegel versus Lynch matter was before the appellate division. In this case, three judges made referrals to the Office of Attorney Ethics about respondents' conduct, and this necessitated investigative work to be completed. These matters were then tried before a special master. The Disciplinary Review Board issued its decision approximately 15 months after the case was transmitted to the board, and approximately 7 months after the board transmitted its decision to this court, an order to show cause was scheduled by the court and listed for today's date. This court has also emphasized the seriousness of the ethical infractions in light of all relevant circumstances must be considered when determining the quantum of discipline to be imposed. Now, perhaps if this was a case in which an attorney momentarily lost their cool and said a discourteous comment to or about a judge or an adversary, then reasonably we could chalk that up to an attorney having a bad moment, maybe even a bad day. And depending upon what was said, we could even reasonably consider whether the attorney would have made such a comment if they had time to reflect on what had come out of their mouth. Now, contrast that with the situation that we have before this court. In Assignment Judge Weissenbeck's referral to the Office of Attorney Ethics, he emphasized that he admonished respondent on the record concerning the propriety of statements made by respondent about respondent's adversary when respondent submitted Mr. Siegel's certification, referring to that attorney as being a co-conspirator in an outrageous scam and fraud perpetrated upon the court. Judge Weissenbeck reported that he suggested to the respondent that he retract those statements, but the respondent didn't do that. Judge Farber reported that when the entire Siegel versus Lynch case is viewed in its totality, by examining all of the pleadings, motions, the orders to show cause, the letter campaigns to the court, motions to reconsider, motions to recuse judges, motions to transfer venue, emergent appeals, interlocutory appeals, and a related civil lawsuit that respondent is perceived by Judge Farber to be more than an advocate, more than an advisor, but an attorney who insinuated himself into the malevolent actions of his client. Judge Farber indicated that in applications to recuse him, respondent constantly charged without any basis that Judge Farber would be swayed by Judge Weissenbeck and by Judge Bozanellis. Judge Farber indicated that the charges are insulting and demeaning to the judiciary. Judge Farber concluded his referral letter by indicating that respondent's conduct is abhorrent and well beyond the pale. In Judge Kirsch's referral letter to the Office of Attorney Ethics, he pointed out that the appellate division issued a 56-page opinion affirming the trial court in all respects and emphasized respondent's abuse of the judicial process, bad faith, and unreasonable legal and factual positions. In respondent's brief to the court, he describes his actions as isolated incidences. So can respondent's actions be considered merely isolated incidences which warrant an admonition, if any discipline at all? With regard to Hall versus Hall, respondent failed to comply with multiple orders to file a complete case information statement on behalf of his client. He submitted more than 12 requests for adjournments and or extensions of time. He repeatedly filed claims and motions riddled with false and inflammatory accusations and failed to withdraw and or correct them. He filed at least 10 baseless appeals to the appellate division and to this court. He failed to provide tax returns as repeatedly directed to by the trial court. His client was found in violation of litigants' rights at least 6 separate times. At oral argument regarding recusal, respondent mentioned the judge's place of worship in a synagogue in the town in which the judge resides and tried to argue that somehow that was relevant or provided a basis for Judge Kirsch's recusal. Respondent on Mr. Hall's behalf appended 19 orders entered by the trial court. Appealed 19 orders entered by the trial court. The appellate division found no merit whatsoever to the trial court's impartiality. Respondent threatened Ms. Hall's attorney with a lawsuit if she served a court order on Mr. Hall's employer. Respondent sent a letter to the Union Vicinage Probation Division that they not engage in any further contact with respondent's client's employer. And in a certification, Mr. Hall warned that the trial court, that probation at the court's discretion was harassing his employer and that these actions are most likely actionable. This is what he was telling the trial court about their actions. Respondent requested that his client's employer refrain from withholding Mr. Hall's income, just violate the trial court's orders. Judge Kirsch testified that he spent hundreds of hours of his own time on motion after motion, on orders of recusal, on hearings and rehearings, etc. And with regard to the Siegel versus Lynch case, respondent pleaded that Lynch was liable for intentional infliction of emotional distress. And when the trial court dismissed the complaint as a matter of law, he kept filing motion for leave to amend the complaint to include this claim over and over. During the course of Siegel versus Lynch, respondent referred to Lynch and her attorney as co-conspirators in a scam and fraud perpetrated upon the court in an effort to make Siegel pay for Lynch's attorney's fees. Judge Weissenbeck admonished the respondent about such statements, which were unsubstantiated and unsupported. Respondent still made them, and he didn't withdraw the allegation. What respondent did, though, was to file 5 motions to recuse Judge Weissenbeck. Respondent filed at least a dozen motions or certifications, alleging that Judges Kirsch, Weissenbeck, and Farber should be recused. Judge Farber found it insulting to Judge Bonzanellis and Weissenbeck to imply that they would try to strong-arm another trial judge, and insulting to Judge Farber that if such an attempt was made, that he would relent. Judge Weissenbeck testified to extra time he had to spend considering what he termed respondents' frivolous motions and arguments. And Judge Farber testified about the amount of time he spent reviewing all the motions and the certifications referenced in the complaint. Judge Farber testified he ended up doing a lot of the work on weekends. In a case like respondents with such egregious facts, where this respondent repeated his attacks on multiple judges, a short suspension will send a message to him and potentially other attorneys from ever considering that such misconduct is acceptable behavior. Respondent even saw fit to mention Judge Kirsch's hometown and place of worship while arguing his client's case in court. Such baseless acts on the judiciary undermine public confidence and the bar. Respondents' actions were intimidation by litigation. Actions have consequences. The Office of Attorney Ethics respectfully requests that respondent receive a suspension, that he be required to take extra ethics classes, and that he write apology letters to the three referring judges who were each greatly impacted by respondent's actions. Thank you.
Questions? I just want to ask you a question about the timeline. Did the misconduct, alleged misconduct, occur between 2008 and 2011? Is that
the conduct continued, and it wasn't until the cases were finished that is when they referred to our office.
Well, I'm just looking. You can just tell me if this is correct or not correct, because I am now looking at respondent's brief. He's saying that the misconduct occurred between 2008 and 2011. Is that correct or incorrect?
I believe that is correct.
Okay, and the grievance was not filed until 2013 and 2014. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that the complaints were not filed until 2017.
Although, Your Honor, if I may,
go ahead.
The matters were put on untriable for just shy of 2 years based upon respondents' counsels.
I'm just trying to, yes. I'm just looking for the timeline. I'm not attributing fault to anyone. And the complaint was not filed until 2017. Is that correct or not correct?
Bear with me for 1 second. I have a chronology here. With regard to XIV 2013-495E, there was an amended complaint that was filed May 3rd, 2018. With regard to XIV 2014-0104E, the complaint is dated November 30th, 2017.
Okay. And we're in 2021 now. And I take it you're not disputing the parts in respondent's brief where he talks about his significant community and professional contributions over the years.
Your Honor, if I may, we respect the fact that he has engaged in such conduct. He reported in his brief extensively about the different charitable acts that he's done and his work in the community. And that is to be appreciated. But actions have consequences. And we have to sometimes think about the visual of what it was like for Judge Kirsch to have spent hundreds of hours responding to baseless motions.
You gave us the visual. We got that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McNamara. Gross.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Mr. Resnick and counsel. I find myself here in a very delicate balancing act, looking to try and zealously advocate on behalf of Mr. Resnick and to defend the accusations made against him, and at the same time, trying not to indicate in any way that Mr. Resnick has not been remorseful for this conduct. Mr. Resnick is remorseful. These two cases were terribly unfortunate incidents and blemishes on Mr. Resnick's otherwise exemplary career as a member of our bar. In my view, to the extent that's worth anything, it's not exemplary of his character. The 13 letters that your honors have, exemplary of Mr. Resnick's character. The way he gives back to the bar and to the bench, it's part of his character and should be weighed here in this manner. And when this case came into my office and I picked up the brief from the OAE, the first thing I wanted to look at is, what were they looking for? Was it different from the special master and the DRB? And I looked firstly at the last page. And when I turned to the last page and I read some of the language of the brief, in the concluding paragraph where the OAE accuses Mr. Resnick that he saw fit to point out where Judge Kirsch resided and worshiped, and threatening conduct, the words from the brief exactly are, this was threatening conduct, not the words or actions of an attorney who fully appreciates the gravamen as his deeds. And the brief goes on, as such, the OAE respectfully recommends that appropriate discipline in this case is a short suspension. And reading that language, it's hard to disagree with it. But when you scratch below that language, the actual allegations in this case don't match up to the words in the brief. Mr. Resnick was never charged by the AOE with threatening conduct or threatening a judge. That doesn't appear anywhere in the record. It's the first thing I looked for. I pulled up the transcript of the Hall motion for recusal.
And when you counsel, did he reveal the judge's name and address and place of worship?
No, Your Honor.
He never did?
Not the address of Judge Kirsch. It doesn't appear anywhere in the record.
Well, that's right. So that's a lie that he did that. By the AOE.
A misstatement of the record, and I can tell Your Honor what Mr. Resnick did do. He did indicate the hometown, but not the address, and it's just as a matter of public record. I Googled it when the judge was appointed. It's prominently in the newspaper of his hometown.
That wasn't my question. I wasn't asking for your explanation. I was wondering, what did he actually do?
He indicated by way of query, questioning the court as to whether the judge's hometown or perhaps some other affiliation of the court, by through some other affiliation of the court, that the court had some relationship with Mr. Hall's ex-wife, and queried as to whether perhaps it was the synagogue, and stated
I asked you a very simple question. I didn't want to hear your explanation. Did he or did he not reveal the address?
He did not.
Did he or not reveal where he worshipped?
He did not. He indicated generally, questioning whether...
He indicated generally the town where he lived?
Yes.
And the temple where he worshipped?
Not by name. Not by name. Questioned whether there was some relationship through a synagogue or a country club, and that, listening to the tapes, you can hear Mr. Resnick mention the name of a country club. That was mentioned on the record by way of query as to whether there was an affiliation.
Well, that's your explanation, but it was mentioned on the record by your client.
Yes, sure.
Correct? Okay, thank you.
And in terms of that being a threat or being taken by the court as a threat, when you read the transcript at pages 62, 63 through 66, and that's AOE 20, there's no threatening contention by Mr. Resnick. There are no threats by Mr. Resnick, and the court didn't perceive it as a threat. And I know, not just from the context of reading it, but when you look at page 77, almost towards the end of that hearing, what the court said on page 77 is, thank you. First of all, my compliments to both lawyers. It's a difficult case. There's a lot of emotion here with the respective clients, and I commend both lawyers for your advocacy on behalf of your clients today. I would think that the last thing Mr. Resnick would contemplate after leaving an emotionally charged hearing like this is when the judge commends him and his adversary that he's going to be the subject of an ethics filing for what he did.
Which judges made referrals to the OAE?
Uh, Kirsch, that particular judge, made the referral to the OAE, for sure. I'm looking really to respond to some of the, in my view, some of the language in the brief and the argument by the OAE that is stretching the facts as to Mr. Resnick's conduct.
But you're not suggesting that the implications and the accusations by your client towards Judge Kirsch were appropriate?
I'm not suggesting they were appropriate, Your Honor. What I'm suggesting is they don't amount to threats. Threats, especially today, is a charged word. It's shocking to me as a member of this bar and to Mr. Resnick also. Threats were not part of this case. There's also another interesting item, and I wrote it down. I heard it in an argument by the OAE, that Mr. Resnick, on behalf of Mr. Hall, appealed 19 orders. That didn't happen. It said it in the brief as well. That respondent on Mr. Hall's behalf appealed 19 orders by the trial court during this litigation. This is an important fact, an important distinguishment, because it wasn't this lawyer that appealed 19 orders from Judge Kirsch. It was Judge Penza who succeeded the respondent, Mr. Resnick, in the representation and pursued relief in the appellate division of 19 orders. And we all know you cannot argue something that wasn't raised below. Judge Penza was constrained by the record to argue the exact same facts, the exact same arguments that Mr. Resnick raised to the trial court. And when you'll take a look at the appellate decision, and it's 54 or 56 pages long, it's a substantial analysis. Nowhere in the appellate division decision does the appellate division come down on Judge Penza and accuse him of engaging in unethical conduct, of crossing the line, of raising frivolous arguments. The appellate division doesn't do it. The OAE I'm sorry.
You're not arguing, I take it, that your client did not act unprofessionally before Judge Weisenbeck, Judge Farber, and Judge Kirsch? Or are you? Are you unwilling to concede?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Am I willing to concede that there's conduct that crossed the line? I think Mr. Resnick conceded that on a number of occasions. One was the fraud comment to with respect to Mr. Donahue. And I think we know that that does not have a place here and should not have been said. With respect to other of the conduct that Your Honors have seen before you, both identified by the DRB, Judge Fullilove, I think our position is we consent and agree to the relief set forth by the special master. That's not something that I'm contesting here.
Or you're not contesting the findings by the special master, right?
I am not. What I am contesting is how I feel, looking at this brief and this record, the Office of Attorney Ethics has unfairly ramped up the rhetoric as to Mr. Resnick. And those are only two examples I gave you. There's a third example. The admonishment comment that Judge Weisenbach admonished Mr. Weisenbach. No lawyer wants to be admonished by a judge. It happens, hopefully, very, very infrequently. And when the court admonishes a lawyer, you take note. That's not what the record revealed with the interchange between Judge Weisenbach and Mr. Resnick. It was for him to consider, and I'm not just mincing words. You have to read the transcript and read the words and the exchange between Judge Weisenbach and Mr. Resnick, and it was Judge Weisenbach wisely asking Mr. Resnick to reconsider the word fraud. And perhaps that was not the best choice, and that he was going to keep the matter fresh in his mind, or words to that extent, and give Mr. Resnick an opportunity to reconsider whether he wants to redact that word. That wasn't an admonishment. And Mr. Resnick, as a lawyer, was constrained by his client, Mr. Siegel, who was also a lawyer. And the application, unfortunately, was based upon Mr. Siegel's certification. And Mr. Resnick was not permitted by his client to redact that word. Now, I understand lawyers are gatekeepers, and that's one of our roles. When our client comes up with some bizarre notion or wants to file the same motion again and again, part of our role is to put on the brakes and say, no, we can't do that. Mr. Resnick has learned from this experience. This experience in these two matters and the results that have transpired over the last 10 years have affected Mr. Resnick. Now, we're not here to sob for him. He's not a victim. But
this may take you back to the point you've just made, but I was wondering if you could explain for us how respondent ended up engaging in the crossing the line multiple times as he did. Set aside the OAE brief. What happened here? Why did this take place over an extended period?
I think Mr. Resnick was a young partner at a firm perhaps pressuring him in a number of ways. And in these two matters, the clients were lawyers. And lawyers, one of which was a custody case that was highly charged with issues of intentional infliction of emotional distress that went up to the appellate division. And another was also involving a relationship between a lawyer who was a father and his children and rights relating to payment of college expenses. And I think Mr. Resnick has since developed the skills and more of the...
So client pressure was a factor as well as law firm?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's clear in the record that there's client pressure. And you can see that in the Hall matter in particular. When Judge Kirsch orders the CIS and the tax returns, what can Mr. Resnick do except advise his client? The AOE makes much of it, and Judge Kirsch does also, but it's not Mr. Resnick's, it's not within his ability to be able to produce the CIS. He doesn't have the financial information. He can't sign that form. He doesn't have the tax returns. It's certainly within his ability to advise his client and the risks that his client faces in the event that the client fails to comply. And we see that in one of Judge Kirsch's opinions, where Judge Kirsch spends a paragraph or two going through the record and detailing how it was Mr. Hall that failed to participate. It was Mr. Hall that didn't provide the CIS. It was Mr. Hall who didn't provide the tax returns. That is beyond the scope of a lawyer's ability sometimes to control a client who's gone off the rails.
How about the dozen recusal motions that Mr. McNamara spoke to? Does your client today believe there was a basis for any of them?
Well, for sure, yes. And one of them dealt with Judge Weisenbach, unfortunately, where there was a motion filed for recusal. And I think Judge Weisenbach, my recollection of the record, is denied it. And there was an emergent appeal taken. And that appeal was granted. And a stay of an ongoing trial was entered. And a three-judge panel was impaneled to look at the circumstances involving Judge Weisenbach and whether there was some improper contact or letter communications with Judge Malone. And before the merits of that could be reached, Judge Weisenbach had recused himself, fortunately. But that incident, unfortunately, tainted the matter, not so much for Mr. Resnick, but for his client, Mr. Siegel, a lawyer, who was blown away by the fact that a sitting judge would write a letter to another sitting judge looking to influence other litigation. I think it was Judge Fuentes in the appellate division, the record makes clear, that Judge Weisenbach had become the lawyer for Lynch. And that incident really impacted Mr. Resnick's ability to move forward in that case without making another recusal motion when Judge Farber made some remarks in an order about Judge Weisenbach and perhaps the propriety of Judge Weisenbach reaching out to Judge Malone. So now Mr. Siegel is of the belief that he is not going to get a fair shake in Union in Sussex County, and an application was made as the case progressed, and it seemed more and more unfair to Mr. Siegel, providing Mr. Siegel with additional facts, which came to be set forth in a certification for another motion for recusal. These are lawyers who are clients. Now, while Mr. Resnick ultimately is reviewing and files these certifications, these clients have impact. They understand the system. When they see something unfair, they are certainly pressuring Mr. Resnick to file another recusal motion based upon additional facts that come to Mr. Siegel or Mr. Hall's attention.
So does your client today maintain that those additional 10, no small number, as anyone would agree, recusal motions were founded?
Well, lumping them all together, Judge, and looking at the record as a whole, it seems sort of excessive. You can't say that it's not. But did the OAE in the hearing below, was there a factual analysis as to each separate one? I don't think so. I looked at that record.
Isn't the volume sufficient, counsel? The fact that there were 10, all 10 denied? Does the OAE have to go through every one to determine that there's been a harassment
no,
pattern?
No, Your Honor. I mean, I think we can concede that it's too much.
Well, you seem to be suggesting that the OAE did a faulty analysis because they didn't look at each one. I'm saying to you that just the total number, don't you think that would be sufficient to be considered harassment?
I would think it's over the top, Your Honor. I think it's over the top. And I think that since that time, you can tell that that Mr. Resnick has changed the manner in which he practices law. Mr. Resnick is not a risk for repeat behavior, not simply because of his actions and character and service to the bench and the bar, but he has learned from these incidents. He is able to, with perhaps some less hair and some grayer hair, to push back on clients and say no and do the right thing. And we haven't seen this sort of conduct since 10 years ago in these two high-pressure, high-stake cases. I do want to point out something with respect to the repeated motions to amend, because that was one of the contentions raised by the OAE, that the repeated motions to amend in the Siegel case was frivolous. Excuse me. And I took a look at the complaints and read the proposed complaints, and the complaints have different sets of facts. And I would argue to your honors that as time progressed and as the case became worse for Mr. Siegel, and he is not seeing his daughter and is alleging constructive kidnapping, and he's not seeing his son, and there's interference by a psychologist or a psychiatrist, that these are additional facts woven in to proposed complaints, and given our liberal amendment standards and the success that Siegel had with the appellate division and Mr. Resnick in trailblazing some new law, that these motions to amend were not frivolous on their face.
What?
That they were made in good faith.
Maybe it'll be a favor to the court. Why don't you briefly sum up for us, briefly, the ethical violations found by Judge Fullilove and what they pertain to. Because you're not appealing that. You're accepting
That's
it.
Correct.
So I want to hear what you're accepting.
For count one, I think Judge Fullilove found no violation on the multiple motions for leave to amend in the Siegel case.
I want the violations, not the ones that he didn't find. Let's just go through those. That's what we hear about now.
The issue with Mr. Donahue on the motion where counsel sought to be relieved in the payment of attorney's fees. There was a violation found.
Okay. Go ahead.
You look at the
there were violations found with respect to the recusal of multiple motions for recusal and transfer with respect to Judge Farber.
If it helps you, you can look at the DRB decision in the area of page 38.
Uh, I also have notes on it.
Whatever's easier for you. And
thank you. The failing to, well, no violation for of 8.4 that finding, well, that was not a violation. No violation of 8.4, a violation of 3.1 and 3.2 relating to the recusal motions. With respect to the Hall case, there was no violation found with respect to the CIS. There was a violation of RPC 3.1 and 3.2 found with respect to a letter to the court concerning that Hall's new wife in California may be filing an action and to looking to obtain an adjournment of a scheduling of that case. And that was found to be a violation of 3.1 and 3.2. There was no violation found for the tax returns. With respect to the recusal of Judge Kirsch, there was a violation found with respect to finding some connection with the country club or the synagogue. There was a violation found of RPC 8.2 due to the residence issues. No violation as to 8.4. There were violations found.
The residence issue, what is that?
The mentioning on the record that Judge Kirsch resided in a certain town, and perhaps there was an affiliation between Judge Kirsch and in some way through his affiliation with a synagogue or a country club with Mrs. Hall or Ms. Hall. There were violations found of RPC 3.1 and 3.2. And with respect to the third count, the mentioned by the AO, the Office of Attorney Ethics, the threatening language of litigation against opposing counsel, the probation department, relating to pursuing the judgment and the child support issue, there was no violation found of 8.4. Judge Fully Love found that there was no clear and convincing evidence that respondents' actions wasted judicial resources. So we are not
a lot of aggregate misconduct. Would you concede?
I'm over sorry,
that's a lot of aggregate misconduct over a period of years.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It is. Aside from emphasizing the mitigating factors, which is set forth in the brief, I think that
and you think that a censure is off the mark. That's the recommendation of the DRB for the entirety of this misconduct over a course of years.
Do I think a censure is out of bounds? It's a judgment call, Your Honor. Is a censure out of bounds? I would say a suspension is out of bounds. I would say a censure, while strong, is probably within the framework of possibilities and within the framework of punishment or deterrence that wouldn't make me cringe. Obviously, as an advocate, I'm looking for the admonition, and when I review the record in detail and trying to go through each instance in a meticulous nature, I can pinpoint how oftentimes there's a reasonable basis for something that Mr. Resnick did. Either he relied upon a client's certification or his own good faith belief that he was doing the right thing. Obviously, in hindsight, and having the benefit of this record on these two cases over a period of years, Mr. Resnick overstepped the bounds of zealousness on several occasions. And that's unfortunately while.
So your position is that only in hindsight do you realize that 19 recusal motions may be out of bounds?
No, Your Honor.
In hindsight?
No, Your Honor. When I look at this record, obviously I'm looking at it after the fact. And when you look at all of these things in these two cases going on simultaneously, I agree with your comment. I agree with your comment that this was unfortunate that these cases got out of control for the litigants and for Mr. Resnick and for us as members of the bar who have to police this. But we are at a point here in Mr. Resnick's career where I think, and the record speaks for his record speaks for himself, that he has surpassed this, that he has grown through and from this. And I don't want to be repetitive, but I think that there are instances here that are nuanced, and that when you look at this collectively in a mass, it seems and feels horrible. And those were some of my reactions when I read the brief. But parceling through issue by issue to Mr. Resnick's defense and looking to be an advocate to the extent that I'm not crossing the lines of offending notions of an appropriate deterrence, there are instances here where I think that the lower courts may have gotten it wrong in terms of their view of Mr. Resnick.
Mr. Gross, you are an experienced attorney in family law, as I understand.
Not in family law.
Not family law, but in
business divorces.
Business. Your clients in a field in which clients have been known to perhaps encourage lawyers to cross lines, and I'm not comparing that field with any other, but there have been instances where certainly records indicate that clients are pushing lawyers very hard. What has your client learned about where to draw the line with clients? And I don't mean any specific client. I don't mean these two who are highlighted in this record, but just in general. Because obviously we have to look to other lawyers who may be under extraordinary pressure from clients to just keep making motions and to attack judges and to attack adversaries and to cross lines.
Well, this conduct has never repeated. He hasn't come close to that line. He's never engaged in anything like this ever again since 2011, and it's been 10 years. And so I would say that Mr. Resnick's actions speak far louder than any words that I could articulate to this body. You don't have to take my word for it. I would offer, if your honors are willing, to hear from Mr. Resnick, who I know would like to address this body for a brief minute, so you can get a feel and a flavor for his remorse. He's been through this process. And I think it would be helpful. But of course, I stand ready to answer any additional questions. I think that a suspension of Mr. Resnick does not serve our practice, does not serve our bar. It doesn't serve our bench, where Mr. Resnick has become an advocate for reducing caseloads and settling cases. It hurts Mr. Resnick's clients. And I think it's too much looking at the case law, looking at Geller, looking at Hoffman and others. I think that a suspension is too much under these circumstances. This was 10 years ago. I would not describe this as long-standing conduct. Is it an isolated incident? It's not an isolated incident, unfortunately. Somehow something went wrong in terms of judgment, in terms of being able to push back and do the right thing and say no to clients 10 years ago. The decision that this courts make should not punish Mr. Resnick. It should deter. He has been deterred. He has learned from this, and in my view remains, since that time, if we draw the line, an exemplary member of the bar. I wish more lawyers would step up, teach classes, lecture, assist the bench with settling cases, provide scholarship money to students who have a passion for the law, volunteer, and give back. And that's all of what Mr. Resnick is about. That is his character, having nothing to do with what happened in that time period from 2008 through 2011. Mr. Resnick does this irrespective of that and will continue to do so. I think that if this court issues a suspension, it's too harsh of a remedy here. It's too harsh on the bar, and it's unfair to Mr. Resnick's clients and overreaching in terms of what happened 10 years ago in, it's hard to say isolated, but in these two cases involving lawyers pressuring a client in cases where parental rights and parental issues were at stake.
Other questions, anyone?
Yeah. May I invite Mr. Resnick?
Yes, we don't ordinarily hear from attorneys unless they're facing disbarment, but we will hear from Mr. Resnick for a minute. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. I appreciate your time and letting me just speak very briefly. I've had a great honor appearing before this court, of course, on very important issues of family law. And I'm sorry, very sorry, that the subject matter is me today, you know, that I'm here discussing. But as Mr. Gross indicated, I've spent my entire career in the family law arena. I believe there's no higher calling in terms of protecting, you know, the children that are involved, certainly the mothers and fathers that are involved, and what they entrust me with. And so I've had a special emphasis in my career on a very emotionally charged and very difficult area of parental rights in terms of access. And I always try to strike a balance between, you know, being a zealous advocate, obviously, and trying to keep conduct myself in a professional manner. And unfortunately, these were two cases happening at the same time. 2010, 2011 is really when a bulk of this occurred. And obviously, you can see it, I didn't get it right at the time, especially as to gatekeeping. This was all from the client's opinions and certifications and the things they wanted into the record, and I should have been a better gatekeeper, and I've certainly learned from that, as indicated, and I'm certainly remorseful as to what occurred long ago at this point, at that point in time. And I can say with conviction that there is no risk in terms of any repeat conduct. There hasn't been since. There will not be going forward. I can say that I've been in hundreds of trial days, hundreds of court appearances, litigated several large cases. I've appeared before Your Honors recently, amicus, in the JRR case. And on all these cases, all these occasions, I've certainly prided myself in representing the clients to the best of my ability, and at times even making law, making new arguments. And that's what I've been able to do in a tireless and certainly exemplary fashion. And in all those times, I've never had an issue. There's only been four judges that I've actually been involved in any kind of recusal applications in almost 25 years. That's it, four times, you know, in terms of the particular judges. And in the first judge, the appellate division removed that judge respectfully on an emergency basis. That was in another case. And then the three judges that are involved here. And that's it. And I certainly am loath to go near any kind of application like that going forward. But I have spent my entire career independent of that, giving back, helping judges clear calendars. I sit in three counties. I do pro bono work at the appellate level and at the Supreme Court level, certainly. And all my volunteer works are certainly put forth in the briefs and what's happened. But I am sorry for what happened in these two cases. I've had no issues since, as I can say. And it, no matter what the court does, independent of all of that, it's not going to happen again. And it hasn't been repeated, and it will not be repeated. So thank you very much for letting me speak.
Mr. Resnick?
Yes.
Is there anything you'd like to say to the three judges on the record?
Yes, I certainly have said I'm sorry and apologize for certainly any offense that the client's commentary, you know, the venting and their certifications may have caused, and that does not happen and will not happen again. Whatever the merits were and the arguments, that extra language did not need to be in there. And again, the lawyers felt strongly at the time, and if I was here today and I could teleport myself back, it wouldn't have happened. you know, now that I'm, you know, double my career at this point, and I understand what occurred and what does not need to occur going forward.
Questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to counsel for the able presentation of your positions.
Thank you.
Advisement, courts and research.